At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
From the pits of despair going into the last international break to a mood that is pretty much sunshine and rainbows going into this one. Manchester City have gone unbeaten in their last seven since the players last joined up with their national teams. That isn't to say that there aren't any issues that need ironing out, but they are just 3 points off the top of the table, and they're the Premier League's leading scorers. Plenty to be happy about on this week's Blue Moon Podcast. It was a bit harum-scarum at the end of the game with Brentford, but the team dug in and got over the line. We're going to look at the talking points from that game on today's show. Plus, we'll chat to the Athletic's Duncan Alexander as Pep Guardiola became the fastest manager to 250 Premier League wins. Then, as it's International Week, we've got license to do something a little bit more unorthodox. You probably don't know the name Lucy Clarkson, but City fans of a certain vintage might well have seen her delivering a match ball or two at Main Road in the early 2000s. We'll be speaking to her about the time that she was the official Lara Croft when the game's publisher was City's shirt sponsor. All of that on the way. I'm David Mooney, and today I am joined by two City fans. We've got Andy McNabb.
Hi, David. You okay?
Not too bad, thank you. And presenter Adam Monk. Hello, Adam. Adam, you've managed to mute yourself immediately. That's an immediate...
That's always good for a presenter, isn't it?
Just black mark, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do I do that again, or do you want me to leave that in?
No, I think that's quite good. Roll with the punches.
There we go. Okay, so Adam's here anyway. Yeah, you might be able to hear him or not.
I'm good.
Let's start then with the Brentford game, because Andy, I'm always really, really conscious of avoiding cliches and everything else. But this was a literal game of two halves, like the performance in the first half, the performance in the second half, night and day. What are your feelings now that you've had time to kind of digest the game and it's kind of settled? What are your feelings about it now?
I thought it was a great win at the end of the day. I mean, I think one thing that I forgot about until probably Sunday night was the fact that we'd just come back from Monaco and away leg in the Champions League, or away game in the Champions League these days, and then got to Brentford away at the weekend. And nowhere in the last 5 years has that been a good thing. Whether we've won titles or not, they've always been difficult games at Brentford. And straight after a Champions League game, it's always going to be a harder task. So in the end, I thought it was a great result. 3 points is always good anyway, obviously, but I was really pleased with the way we played in the first half and the way we dug in the second, when we're obviously tiring and they've had a week off. They're fresh and they've had a week off, and they've had a week of on the training pitch working out the tactics and everything else, and we've had probably a session before we got to Brentford. So, yeah, I think overall I was pretty impressed with it.
Yeah. Adam, it was the first half especially, City were really doing a lot to force Brentford back. The second half, I can't decide whether City were unable to force Brentford back or Brentford just got a little bit more ambitious, because you could argue that in the first half they just didn't show any ambition whatsoever. Then in the second half, tried to hit City, and as Andy says there, I know City could take the chances a bit more in the first half, but you've got to be impressed with the way that they dug in the second.
Yeah, well, it's an upturn in events, ultimately, in terms of second halves that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 weeks. Now, I only actually was able to watch the first half of the Brentford game. I was in Sweden, so I was on a dodgy stream. Wait, can I say that? No, I don't know, was I? But I was watching it, and then I had to go do something else because we were filming a doc. But obviously, all my mates were watching it at the time, and I saw like Twitter and stuff, and the general consensus was it was backs against the wall. However, that was the case against Monaco. We should have scored a couple more against Monaco, but we allowed them back into the game. And then obviously, the less said about how we played at the Emirates in the second half, the better, in my opinion, although it was different and dogged. But this time we came out with 3 points, which means something. That means that the players almost are adapting to learn how to dig deep and survive, which, like Andy said, you need in title races. It's non-negotiable. You're going to find phases like that in a season, in certain matches, and games ebb and flow. And ultimately, what people have got to come to terms with, I think, is that the Premier League is a lot more now of a level playing field than it's ever been. Teams recruit so well. They've got really good management, good players. Anyone can beat anyone. And it used to be a cliche. Now it's a reality. So I think that overall, the start we've made to the season, and particularly the fact that we dug in and got the result against Brentford with players on the pitch who sometimes a lot of fans aren't happy with, the likes of Mateus Nunes. I think people throw their toys out the pram when he's brought on the pitch. He certainly did at the Emirates, and he was fine. So for me, there's a lot of positives to take from the fact that we didn't concede and throw away 3 points this time. So I'm quite happy with it.
Andy, let's kind of split it into two halves then to start with. And we'll start with looking at City's attack. Erling Haaland's now scored a Premier League goal on all the grounds he's visited apart from one. Although he did it for Salzburg, so that technically counts.
I don't think this stat's right. Can I just...
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm pretty right. He scored at Kenilworth Road, but in the FA Cup, not the Premier League.
Oh, you're right, he did.
So it's Anfield and Kenilworth Road.
So if we're saying that he scored at all Premier League grounds, it has to have been in the Premier League, doesn't it? Otherwise,
yeah, I think so.
Otherwise, the Salzburg goal for an Anfield would count, wouldn't it? So,
yeah.
Okay, so I'll get on to Opta about that after the show. Nevertheless.
Hello, everyone. Adam Monk here. Apologies for the interruption. Issuing correction on my previous statement. It turns out Erling Haaland did not, in fact, play at Kenilworth Road on that day when City won 2-1. So I've been left with egg on my face. I am a moron. Anyway, yes, enjoy the rest of the show.
Erling Haaland scored a lot of goals. He's got another one this week, Andy.
Yeah.
His form at the start of the season is nothing short of excellent, is it?
No, I think we all know what he is as a goal scorer. He's proven that year on year, even a bad year. Last year, he was 30 goals last season, and he had a bad year, apparently. So he's just a goal machine, and we all know how good he is. I think the one thing that's impressed me the most, and I think it's bound to happen as you go through your career, is his work rate and his desire to drop back in. And he's obviously been given that license to drop back in and work and take the ball deeper. And that's impressed me a lot, because I think there's times when he's looked a bit isolated. And I'm not one of these people who talks about, oh, he's only had 3 touches, you know. I mean, if 2 of them are goals, I don't care, really. I don't care how many touches he got. But it's the way, I think he said it really, really well when he was interviewed. I think it was after the Monaco game, when he talked about, my job is to make space for people and my job is to take defenders away and create these areas for us to work in. And that's what strikers are supposed to do. They always did, by the way. I think one thing that some people seem to forget is big strikers weren't always great goal scorers. I mean, this guy is. That's what makes him a freak. But big strikers, like Emil Heskey, for example, I mean, he was a goal scorer, but he wasn't a Robbie Fowler. He wasn't a Haaland. He wasn't one of these players. He was there to disrupt and to cause problems and to create space for people around him. And that's what Haaland's good at now. He's really, really good at. And he's, physically he's getting stronger, which seems mad, really, but he's only young. He's only, was he 24 still? 25 maybe? So he's got a lot of, he's still got a lot of growing to do physically. So, yeah, the facets that he's got now are far greater than they were 3 years ago when he arrived. So, really impressed with him. I just think he's growing as a player. So
you can see the added responsibility he's taken on already, I think, this season, Adam, with, as Andy says, kind of dropping in and coming to help out where needed and kind of getting involved in the build-up, not just kind of being the figurehead of it at the top. But like on top of all of that, nobody else has been scoring at the minute, and he's gone, right, okay, well, you need the goals, I'll score the goals.
Yeah, I think he would like some help. I'll level with you. I mean, he probably would at some point, But what I was thinking then, actually, like another example is Drogba. Drogba only ever hit over 20 Premier League goals in one season, and he was here for however many years, when he was linking up with Lampard and stuff, dropped deep. That goal at Brentford on the weekend was very Drogba-esque almost. He had his back. He made something out of absolutely nothing, which is obscene. But in terms of him dropping deep, I think it's always something he's been capable of. He's refined it now. But I was also thinking with Pep Linders in now, and you look at the team that Liverpool played with And I'm not saying Haaland's like Firmino by any stretch of the imagination, but the fella who led the line, so to speak, for Liverpool, one of the key components of his game that he had to do that was non-negotiable was drop back a little bit into midfield when need be and be that link man. And I think now we've got Doku, who's becoming a bit more potent and he's attacking the box a little bit more. It's allowing Haaland to drop deep and know that he's going to have runners behind him. Now, I think Jory's still out on Savinho, absolutely. But I think having Doku playing as well as he is allows Haaland to do what he's doing a lot better as well. So, yeah, overall, 18 goals, 3 assists in like 10 games. It is. If that was an Aguero season alone and we stop it now, we'd go, yeah, that's pretty standard, Sergio, that decent season. Go again next year. And he'd have probably had an injury at some point. Like 18 goals, 3 assists is an Aguero season with an injury in it. So we're currently at the start of October. So it's just, we could be looking at this rate, it could be 60 or 70 goals, which when you have that with also, in my opinion, the best keeper in the league, that gives you a chance against anyone.
Yeah, well, we'll come to the goalkeeper in a minute. Just on the help, Adam Foden is getting back to his best this season. Yeah. But I mean, like the Brentford game just needs to finish those chances, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. It'll come. I think it's all about rhythm with Foden at the moment. Obviously, he's not going to the England camp, but I just think he needed that reset over the summer, which he's had. And I think it's just about him now getting the ball in the right areas. Like the season where he won Player of the Year, how many of the goals that he scored were him receiving the ball on the half turn on the edge of the box and then just rifling one in the top corner?
I thought you were going to say how many of those goals were against Brentford. It was like probably all of them.
Yeah, a lot. He does like score against Brentford. But he was scoring a particular type of goal that I don't think we really had the personnel to enable him to do last season. For me, Foden won't ever be a wide player. He can sort of start on the right and occupy central spaces. I think Oscar Bob's similar. I think Ryan Cherky's similar. So I think that's where our problem would be at the moment. Who would be our out-and-out right winger if we wanted to play one? Who I'd be comfortable with? And it'd probably actually be Doku. But then you'd have to move his position. So I think, yeah, with Phil, his all-round game is better. I think from the Derby onwards, I think he was good at the Emirates. The goals will come. Football's a confidence game at the end of the day. If he hits two or three against the side, it'll hit a flow state. So I'm not worried about Phil.
Yeah.
I'll just talk about Phil. I went to the game I was there on Sunday. And it's difficult from an away end, I always think, to read the game properly. But there's two things I noticed is that he's snatching at his chances a bit. And there's a couple of times, because in the first half, obviously the away fans are at the side where Savinho was on the left. And there's a couple of times where he should have played Savinho in. The first 6 minutes of the game, you've looked at his two chances there where Savinho was making a run. He's asked for it. He's pointed for it to be played through the lines or whatever. I think the first one, he points for it to be played through the lines behind the centre-half. And then ends up playing it behind him. And then the second time he shoots when he's got a 3-4 yard pass to him for him to run onto to get into the 6 yard box. And he decides to shoot. And then his chances that he got as well, he snatched at those a little bit. And I think you're right, Adam. I think he's obviously needs to get his rhythm and everything. But I think sometimes when you're not scoring, when you're supposed to, and you know that everyone wants to help Haaland out and Phil needs a goal and he wants a goal, I think that's when there's sometimes when you snatch at things and you try too hard and you don't relax and play what the game you should be playing. But a couple
fell to his right foot as well, and it's kind of like if that had just fallen to his left, maybe that ends up in the top corner, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's been brilliant, hasn't he? Let's be honest. He's been far, far better than last season. More to what the Phil Foden we know. It's been really enjoyable watching him play. So it'll come. But at the end of the day, Haaland scoring the goals because, you know, we're creating for him. You know, we're giving him them chances, which, by the way, sometimes we weren't doing last year. We didn't, you know, like Adam again was saying, you know, we didn't sort of create the opportunities for people. Doku's been superb. I'm sure it'll all come together at some point. So a few others will score. So,
well, let's look at the wings as well, Andy, because in terms of the wide players for Brentford, Guardiola went with Oscar Bob and Savinho. And I'm interested to get your thoughts from someone who was there, because watching on the TV, it just feels like both of them just need a little bit more of a killer instinct.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing is again, going back to what Adam just said there, what Pep talks about all the time is rhythm of getting into, you know, feet, like of the game because you've played. I mean, Savinho's had a bad start to the season as far as injury and everything else. And I think the Spurs stuff, which I don't know whether that was him or Spurs that were rising, getting that through the press, I don't know. But obviously, he's only been back, I think it's probably his second start, was it, this season? So Oscar Bob as well, you know, he's not had many starts. So I think it's difficult for them to come into a game like that. But I think what happens, what we have to do is we have to understand that Doku needs a rest. And so when people say, oh, what does Savinho bring? Well, first thing he does, he allows Doku to have a break because Doku is going to be playing two games for Belgium over the next few days. He's been playing a lot of football. Savinho comes in and he does work hard. His work rate's there. There's absolutely no doubt. And like I said, the couple of runs he made in the first 6 minutes, for me, if that ball would have been played right, then he would have had more of an impact on the game. So, but he's not in form. He's not doing great. Oscar Bob is, again, another talented lad. Made one great sort of press into the box where he beat three players and nearly created a chance for Phil again. Where to be fair, it just didn't get to him. So I think it shoots, the green shoots there for both of them. But they both work hard. And you know, at the end of the day, you go at Brentford, working hard is like a non-negotiable. And they did. You know, they're in the game. They're doing something. You know, they're not hiding or don't want the ball. Both of them want the ball. And both of them will come back and press. I mean, the amount of times I saw Savinho and Oscar Bob back with the fullbacks. Working when it got tough, you know, that's you can't ask for more than that, really, especially when you're not actually playing brilliantly. So yeah.
Adam, for the, I mean, in terms of sharing the goals around, then if you've got Foden who can start to pick up a few of them, and I mean, Savinho didn't have a great season last season, but the team was an absolute mess for a lot of last season. So maybe we can kind of have a hard reset on him for the start of this one. Bob was coming back from injury. Like, can these players can these start to add the numbers?
Foden will, we know that. I think Cherky will. He's an output machine when he's fit. He's proven that. I think he will be fine. Obviously, Marmoush to come back in. Doku is starting to put the numbers up. But Savinho, for me, doesn't get a pass. I'm sorry. But if you want to... Okay, so if you want to do nothing last season and then not turn up to training and start posting pictures of a gym and threatening to go to Tottenham, and I know the club blocked the move, but ultimately, look, the last player I can remember going on strike, as it was Tevez about 12, 13 years ago, right? But at least Tevez had credit in the bank and a manager who was also a little bit of a hothead and could clash with personnel, and that's what that was over. Look at Leroy Sané when he wanted to leave to Bayern Munich. City fans didn't have a problem because he'd given us two of the best years we've ever seen watching the club. Now, Savinho last season started slow, which is fine. But if you're then going to threaten to go and not train and then come back and score in the League Cup and do this performative badge kissing, for me, you've got to hit the ground running. Because
I think the badge kissing just shows he listens to the podcast, though, because we did that on the podcast that week, and then he was like, "Oh well, yeah, I'll have some of that."
Quite possibly, but ultimately, if you're prepared to not train with your colleagues for 2 or 3 weeks in preparation for the season, and then come back after complaining that you're not going to get game time and stuff, even though he got more game time than Doku last season, let's not forget, and he couldn't produce the numbers, you have then got to hit the ground running and start putting numbers up. I think. He's put the onus on himself with his actions. So for me, I'm just getting kind of fed up with it. Like he's proven he's a good player elsewhere, and I know he's young, but to act the way he did, I'm just kind of like,
go on, Oscar Bob,
you stay and do it. Oh, well, for me, this is Oscar Bob's first season because I know that 2 years ago he was in and out of the team and he scored that goal at Newcastle, but then he missed an entire season through injury last year. So when you, in terms of like rhythm, what we spoke about, when you're coming back in, it's so hard to do after what was a leg break, you know? So I think you can give him a bit of time. He's also a different kind of player to Savinho. Like I said a couple of minutes ago, I think he's probably best in the same spaces as Phil, which is a good problem to have because you've got two very good players, but who kind of play the same way. I think when we're looking forward, I know Savinho signed a new contract. That's the thing. He ain't going anywhere. But I think we are maybe lacking a right-sided player who can hug the width and then just drive and penetrate the penalty area. I think that's an element of the game that we're missing, or put balls across to Haaland. And at points last season, Savinho's final ball was good, so I think that'll come. But I think you were asking a question about goals. I don't know if it'll come from Savinho, because he's not proven that it can. So I'm looking forward to Cherki being back, which I think he is now. And that'll happen after the international break. I think he'll probably start a few games as well, and people have forgotten he was maybe even here, because we only saw a glimpse against Wolves, didn't we?
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Well, let's talk about the defence then as well. Adam mentioned it before, Andy. If you are going to allow chances to come as big as the one-on-one that Thiago got, it's pretty good to have a goalkeeper who's going to block it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, mate.
I should say as well, this isn't to say that I don't think Edison couldn't have made that. Could have made that save as well.
Yeah, I think the thing is, though, is that I think we're doing that thing, aren't we? And we're all doing it, by the way, where we're praising Donnarumma. And we're praising what he's good at. And then people think it's a slight on Edison all of a sudden. And it isn't. They're two different keepers, totally different keepers. Doesn't make either of them rubbish. Doesn't make either of them better than the other. I mean, they're just different. So Edison, we all know what he was good at, which was with his feet. And he was a better shot stopper than what people give him credit for. So the guy's a legend in my eyes, you know, Edison. So forget that. That's one thing. But what we'll be left with is what I think is probably shot stopping the best keeper in the world. And I think that has not come by accident, by the way. That save was fantastic, but that's what he does. And he commands his box. I mean, you're a keeper, mate. You've seen him.
Yeah, I don't command the box either. So I can't relate to that.
To me, Edison, the only thing I used to like get a bit frustrated about with Edison was the fact that he'd stay on his line for corners and that's why he got trapped on there by the defenders. They all knew they'd have one either side of him and they could trap him on his line, and then he wasn't coming anywhere. And that's fine, because, you know, Donnarumma's not as good with his feet. You see what I mean? It's that thing that we do, isn't it? But Donnarumma commands his area, commands his box, like an old-fashioned keeper for me. You know, a Schmeichel-type thing where everything, he comes for everything, he demands that he's going to, you know, he's brave. He's a big guy, isn't he? And he's, you know, him flying at you. I remember when I played and I've got, you know, my goalkeeper 6'5" shouting mine and coming for a corner, and you sort of duck out of the way because you know you're getting taken out. And that's a great feeling, by the way. Donnarumma's that kind of keeper, and he's so impressive to watch. And that save was, like I said, you're not saying Edison couldn't make it, but it was the fact that he came out and commanded that area and cut the space down and left the striker to do only one thing, which would have been a world-class chip over him. And that's difficult to do when you've got a defender right next to you. So, yeah, I can't praise him enough. I'm really impressed with him.
Yeah. Adam, I guess it's good as well. If you've got a team that is maybe creating one or two chances but not taking them at the other end, in games like, I know they conceded against Arsenal, but it was like they were under the cosh against Arsenal for a long time. If they can defend these moments out and they can suffer and get through them, that's only a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, on paper now, our defence is really, really good. Like, it is Vardy, old Diaz at centre-half, Kusunov being as quick as he is when he's fit again. You can play a high line with him because he's got recovery pace. And then, yeah, Donnarumma, I don't think I've ever been as happy, stroke impressed with a signing in years. For someone as big as him, how he gets down as quickly as he does for like low shots is just, it's like he's alien. It's not normal to be able to do what he's actually doing. And I think you've got two ways of having a goalkeeper in a Pep team now that's quite apparent. And I think the signing of Donnarumma is mitigating a lot of the problems that we had last year. So Ederson, yeah, we know, brilliant with the ball at his feet, but at times his shot stopping left little to be desired. At times, not all the time. But then what you can do, if you know that, like last season we were getting hit on transition a lot, and I still think we have been a little bit this season, the way you mitigate that is, like Andy said, by bringing in the best person in the world who's good at stopping the round thing going in the net. It's quite simple, really, isn't it? Like when you face shots and you've got someone who can stop it, you're going to concede less goals. And I think what's telling in the, what I've noticed in like the body language of the team, it's almost like when Donnarumma makes a save now at 1-0, like in the Brentford game, or I think he made one at Monaco. You've got Diaz going and like chest bumping Donnarumma. And it was the one
they're
on
Burma. They're really working on this, aren't they?
Yeah, like the one on the save on Mbeumo in the derby. Eight players went round him, which says to me that half of that team have been going, God, we're glad you're here. That's basically like almost what they're saying. Like we've now got an extra line of defence. It feels like that. And I don't want to take anything away from Ederson. I think he's the greatest goalkeeper this club's ever had and a legend. But they're different. And I think this in this new era now of fast transitional football that's reliant on, you know, more physicality than technicality, Pep's built his team around that. And part of the byproduct of that is conceding more chances. So having the best in class to stop them is just amazing. It's just amazing. He'll win us 15 more points.
Can we talk about his shirt, though, Andy? Because it does look ridiculous, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, he wears an XXL, apparently. I heard rumours that his first game, they didn't know that he had an XXL, so they had to go and get one from the club shop. I heard. I mean, for his first game, because
I can't get my head around it. It looks like when you see him from behind and you see the squad number on it, it just looks like there's far too much yellow there around the number.
He likes
the number's
a big
tiny.
Shirt, though. I mean, he's a big unit, isn't he? But the shirt's even bigger than him, isn't it? So he likes it nice and loose, doesn't he? For whatever reason, but. One thing I've thought about as well is, you know, like some of us are like concerned about the way we're playing now. And I think Donnarumma, and I think with us buying Donnarumma, with us, the way we're the players that we're buying now, with having O'Reilly at right back and this and the other, we do seem more big and physical. And we're trying to compete now with the other teams that are big and physical, because I think that's what the Premier League is now. And I think because of that, we're more comfortable with the last, you know, especially when you, I think in the past what's happened, if you've gone away to Europe, had a hard game in the Premier League on the weekend, and we've still tried to keep hold of the ball, and when we're 1-0 up, keep hold of the ball, and that's when these transitions have happened time and time again. Now, I believe, and I don't know for sure, and we're all guessing, and we're all sort of looking at it in it with a new set of eyes, really, it's the way we play. I do believe that we're quite comfortable sitting in now, and accepting that, because with the thing that we've got is we've got Doku, who's got pace and will drive. Haaland, who is brilliant at getting in behind, as we've seen a million times.
Guardiola said time and time again, you want to go 1v1 against Haaland, do it, because we'll win it. Yeah,
exactly. So if we can create that, you know, and also give the players a physical rest by not having to chase back and leaving that big gap and everything else. And you've got a keeper in Donnarumma who comes in, claims the ball. You've got people, you know, good headers of the ball at the back. You've got O'Reilly, who's a big, tall lad. You've got Guardiola. You've got Diaz. You've got Kusunov. You've got all these players who, even Nunes, you know, taps in with some headers away. So we're a bigger side now. We're a stronger side. And I think we're quite comfortable accepting that pressure and then going again. And breaking and having that, putting the worry on them, thinking, well, I'm 1-1 with Haaland here, or I'm 1-1 with Doku. And if that ball gets cleared, then that's maybe when we get our second goals in the future. You know what I mean? And that is Liverpool-esque, by the way, Adam. I agree with you. You know, that the Linders effect is there for me, from what I can see. So I think there's something in that.
Well, we'll come to the bigger picture a bit later on in the kind of shape of the league this season. But first, the victory at Brentford means that Pep Guardiola has hit the landmark of 250 Premier League wins. He's the 16th manager to do it, but he's the quickest to do it, taking just 349 games. That means that in all of the other games, these not like draws and losses don't even total 100. That is mad. It's 74 fewer than anybody else as well. I've been speaking to Duncan Alexander from The Athletic about this incredible record.
Yeah, he's quite good at football management. I'm not sure that is the sensational information that people have tuned in for, but yeah, it's very good. And just see the sort of list of names that he's beaten to 250, and obviously he said he'd like to go for dinner with your Fergusons and your Wengers, etc. So I think it's funny, isn't it? Because when he joined City, I think everyone kind of figured he'd do three seasons, because that's what he'd done at Bayern. He did four at Barcelona. No one kind of saw him essentially picking up the mantle of Wenger and Ferguson and being that sort of long-term manager at a single club. And it's really, it's an obvious point, but you only really get these sort of statistics when you are that sort of figure and you become sort of embedded in the very fabric of the Premier League.
Yeah, I worked that out as 71.6% of the Premier League games that he's taken charge of, he's won. So I'm a little bit sketchy on this one. I've done as best I can to count up. He's beaten 32 different teams, I know that. I think the only team he's never beaten in the Premier League but has played is Middlesbrough, of all teams.
Yeah, Middlesbrough, weirdly, Middlesbrough are a club who have quite a lot of influence on Premier League records and history, given they're not in the Premier League that often. Obviously, you know, he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something, being one of the most famous mentions of them. But also they beat Mourinho's Chelsea. Shevchenko played in that game. So they do sort of insert themselves into the fabric a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's obvious that it would be a better home record than away record, but it's not that different. 134 wins at home, 116 away. So there are some tough places to go that he's gone and won at.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's been certain seasons. Maybe it's classic football, isn't it? Like recency bias. Obviously, City weren't brilliant last season. So I think the pure sort of aura that they had in the sort of four in a row era has dissipated a little bit. But, you know, there was a spell where City would just go and win. You know, they've obviously won 18 in a row between August 2017 and December 2017, which is the longest winning streak. And yeah, the away wins were ticked up just as fast as the home wins, pretty much. I mean, what I find interesting as well is, you know, people, if you say Guardiola, everyone knows that his first season was a bit of a slow start. Mm. But he won the first six games in that year. And I think if you remember, everyone was kind of like, well, he's cracked it. He's, you know, City going to win every game. That's
it's
it.
It's funny, you watch that team and how that team played back then. It's nothing like it. It's so on a level below what City have been achieving in recent years.
Yeah, and I think Guardiola at the time was like, listen, I've not done much yet. This is not my team and I don't expect us to win every week. And everyone's like, yeah, we've seen what you've done at Barcelona, Bayern. This is, it's over. But it wasn't. So, but obviously that led to him building probably the best team the Premier League's ever seen. So, fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah, just looking at kind of stadiums as well, and you say last season they had a bit of a downturn in form. I mean, if you look at the period between kind of October and January, that's a bit of an understatement what happened. But they last season's basically put paid to a few unbeaten records. He's got 13 stadiums that he's never lost at. There's a lot that he's only been to once, like Stadium of Light, Cardiff City Stadium, Kenilworth Road, that sort of thing. Craven Cottage and Vicarage Road stand out as five out of fives for him. But there's an interesting one in there, in that given City's record against Spurs, away to Spurs at Wembley, he's two out of two. But everywhere else, he's lost.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? That whole Spurs at Wembley era is just, I mean, it sort of coincided a bit with, you know, just before COVID as well. So it's all very, I think it's, people can't even envisage it in their heads properly. Mm. You know, I remember Manchester United winning there under Solskjaer, and it was, again, like a really unusual performance from them at the time. So, yeah, it's fair enough. I mean, obviously, Craven Cottage, it feels like City you know, they often seem to play there quite late on in the season as well, and it's often quite...
It's always really sunny, yeah.
Yeah, and there was obviously Noel Gallagher in the crowd refusing to do the Poznan and stuff. It feels like it's almost quite a celebratory fixture, that one, because usually the league's been wrapped up, or at least, you know, it's quite a sort of good vibes because of the weather, as you say. Vicarage Road, obviously, is hilarious because, you know, Watford... Watford must just... I mean, their record at the Etihad, you know, they just have an abysmal record against City in this era. And luckily, it sounds like they're about to change manager for the 9,000th time, so they might not be back in the Premier League anytime soon, so at least they don't have to worry about playing City anytime soon.
Yeah, we looked at it. We looked at doing a Watford Heaven and Hell episode for this season, and we ended up having to do a City Heaven Watford Hell because Watford haven't beaten City since the 80s. So it's just been like one bad game after another. Bizarrely, though, West Ham are the team that Guardiola's beaten the most. The old West Ham Chester City is a good old link for City there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, that's a good one because obviously West Ham are bad this year. Were bad at points last year, but they have been...
They've been good in spells, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they've won a European trophy. So, yeah, I mean, again, you can kind of, if you look in your mind's eye, the London Road, which is, I always think, the weirdest stadium to watch a game in. I mean, I know it's not, but it looks narrow. It looks like it's an athletic stadium and it's more suitable for the javelin than football. But yeah, City seems to handle that. I mean, some teams haven't handled that well, but Arsenal and City actually seem to handle trips there pretty well.
And while we're on stadiums, obviously the Etihad is Guardiola's most frequently won at. But Goodison, he's won more times at Goodison than anywhere else. 8 times there, London Stadium 7 times. Obviously now he's got a new Everton Stadium to try it at this year.
He has, yeah. Which I think Everton are kind of disproving the you know, accepted knowledge that their teams struggle when they move to a new stadium, because they've started pretty well. They're helped obviously by Jack Grealish quite a lot, who won't be able to play in that game, so that probably will be useful. But yeah, it's interesting because obviously, again, we mentioned the first season, but he went to Goodison, didn't he, in January that season and lost 4-0, and I think that was the first... That was kind of like the real peak of, you know, Fraudiola, and, you know, finally he's been found out by our league and, you know, it's not going to work and accept. So the fact that he's basically taken that and said, all right, I'll just pretty much win at Goodison every time since is a pretty good riposte, I'd say.
Yeah, it's been pretty similar with the King Power as well after that, because the 4-2 at the King Power that season spawned still my favourite ever Guardiola quote when he's been at City, which is he was asked, do your team need to be a bit tougher? And you look at the numbers and how you were doing in that game. You didn't win a tackle for for 40 minutes or something. And his response was basically, I don't coach tackles. What's tackles? And like that, just it still lives in my head, that quote.
It's a brilliant quote because I was at Optra at the time, and you know, as you can imagine, the email lines went berserk. You know, a foreign manager criticizing tackling. You know, the game had officially gone
In our league as well. How dare he? Yeah,
in our league. But I mean, there are much fewer tackles than people think in games. You know, the best defenders don't actually make many tackles because, you know, you jockey players, you cut off space. That's how you defend, essentially. And then, to be fair, that was season one Guardiola. And then, you know, as time went on, I think it's fair to say that there's been iterations of City, particularly now, where they make a lot of tackles and do it very well. So I think he both kind of shaped English football, but I think it's fair to say that there's certain elements where English football has shaped him.
Yeah. Just before we move on to goal scorers as well, because I just want to give this a shout out as well. There are five teams where Guardiola has a better away Premier League record than he does home. Crystal Palace, Everton, Huddersfield, Stoke and West Brom. Palace surprised me a little bit because they always seem to be a bit of a tough game for City. And then there they are. He's done better at Selhurst than he's done at the Etihad against them.
Yeah, I think maybe that's because, remember in the All or Nothing series where they had to try and inject some drama into a season where City were going to win the league by about 2,000 points, and they had the sort of, you know, we've got to go away to Palace, and then obviously drop points in that game, and it was kind of framed by the producers as a disaster when it probably wasn't. But yeah, I mean, you know, Selhurst Park is if you can get a decent record there, you know, as we saw with Liverpool the other week, it isn't an easy place to go, particularly these days.
Yeah. Scorers then, in 27 of those games of Guardiola's wins, there's been a hat-trick. There's been a hat-trick in 1 in 10 of Guardiola's Premier League wins. Actually, 28 hat-tricks, because Foden and Haaland scored one each in one of the Manchester derbies. So like, you can guarantee that like 1 in 10 games, you're going to get a hat-trick in a Guardiola win.
Yeah, and I think at the moment we're on a really quite a big drought of hat-tricks overall in the Premier League. So he needs to work his magic. But for younger listeners, 2006-07, there were 3 hat-tricks in the entire Premier League season. So, you know, Guardiola has made hat-tricks great again. Let's put it that way,
yeah. In 13 of his 250 wins, City have been losing at half-time. There's one journalist who used to revel in City being down, certainly away from home at half-time, because the stat was always City have not won a Premier League game when losing at half-time away from home since about 1993 or whatever it was. And Guardiola's done it 6 times now. So if that's the weight of history against him, fair play.
Yeah, he sorted out an issue, and it's fair enough. I mean, the record, if you're talking about half-time defeats, that maybe he needs to get on his bike and sort out is the fact that Manchester United have not lost a league game at Old Trafford after leading at half-time since 1984 against Ipswich. So give United a lead at half-time this season. And then turn it round, then you genuinely will create statistical history by doing that. So.
Yeah, you always say 2-0 at halftime is not a dangerous scoreline, despite what people say. And I can tell you that City have come from 2-0 down twice in those games.
Well, there you go. Like, one of the greatest managers and teams ever, and he's done it twice. So point proven, I think.
1 in 3 of the goals, around 31%, scored in Guardiola wins have either been Haaland, Aguero or Sterling. Which, it surprised me a little bit that Sterling is higher than Aguero in this list.
Yeah, I think people, again, you know, recency bias, people kind of forget just how important Sterling was in those particularly sort of first 3 or 4 seasons. And, you know, they were kind of 17, 18, 18, 19. The archetypal City goal was, you know, get to the byline, pull it back, and Sterling would tuck it in. You know, his XG map in those years was tremendous, just hundreds of shots in the 6-yard box. And for a while it was, yeah, they kind of perfected football. And I think in some ways that's how people still think of Guardiola's football. You know, I support a League One team, and, you know, teams try and do that in League One now, and people are like, they're trying to play like Pep Guardiola, and he's actually moved on, obviously, with Haaland being a very different sort of weapon. So, but yeah, it was Sterling was very good for a while.
Yeah, we'll come back to Haaland in a second. Just want to shout out Mamoul Akanji, Oscar Bob, Ryan Cherki, Gael Clichy, Rico Lewis, Nico Gonzalez, Tijani Reinders, Savinho and Zabaleta for all scoring just one goal in Guardiola Premier League wins so far. Some of them have the chance to improve that record. Although Zabaleta is the interesting one because he scored 2 goals for City in Guardiola wins, but one of them was an own goal while he was at West Ham.
He's a club man until he dies. I mean, that reminds me of my favourite Zabaleta stat, which is that he only played European club football for teams in converted athletic stadiums, because he was at Espanyol before they moved. He was at City and then he moved to West Ham. So, you know, he knows all about, former running tracks or existing running tracks.
Yeah, definitely. And just to finish on Haaland as well, he has scored at every Premier League ground he's played at now, apart from Anfield. So one to tick off. Although he adds, again, the new Everton Stadium and the Stadium of Light is going to be added to his list. So he'll have to tick those off as well this season. That feels like a remarkable achievement. It doesn't feel like something a lot of players will ever get close to achieving.
No, I mean, if you look at the list of players who've done that, it's, you know, come close. It's, yeah, your Thierry Henry's, your Alan Shearer's, people like that. So, to be honest, Haaland's whole career is just a series of, you know, he is the first person to do this and do this and do this. So, it's funny because I think sometimes my old pals at Opta have to, you know, they have to each week go, oh, we need a new angle on Haaland, and he generally provides. But I guess just to bring it round to the present day, I mean, I think the win at Brentford the other day was, you know, with a goal that maybe we haven't seen from him too much, the sort of style of goal, the sort of goal we saw him score maybe more before he joined City. So, and I think that is kind of, to finish on a Guardiola note, that is kind of his genius, isn't it? A bit like with someone like Ferguson, is he he can keep reinventing his team. He can keep finding different ways to beat the opposition. And that's essentially how you get to such a big win total.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
The Athletic's Duncan Alexander. Before we kind of move into the shape of the Premier League season, I think it's important just to say...
It's a quiz! On Guardiola's 250 Premier League wins.
The looks of resignation on your faces was fantastic then. There we go. This one's going to work a little bit differently to normal. So normally I'd get you to pick a number between 1 and 6, then you'd get the question hidden behind that number. But this time you've got a choice of 6 opposition teams, all of which Guardiola has beaten in the Premier League. There's a trivia question behind each one of them about Pep's wins against them as well. So you can pick from Chelsea, Huddersfield, Liverpool, Newcastle, Tottenham or West Ham. Andy, I'm going to let you go first. Which team would you like?
West Ham.
West Ham, okay. Yeah. Which West Ham player scored an own goal as part of a City win at the London Stadium a season after playing under Guardiola for City?
Zabaleta.
It was Zabaleta. 1-0. Okay, Adam, over to you. You are left with Chelsea, Huddersfield, Liverpool, Newcastle or Tottenham?
Let's go with Huddersfield.
Huddersfield, okay. Who got the late winner at Huddersfield in 2017 when Guardiola City became the first to win a Premier League away game after being behind at half-time since April 1995?
Raheem Sterling.
That was Raheem Sterling.
That game?
It came off his knee, I think. I don't think he knew much about it, but he went in the net. That's all that matters.
He did.
So, equaliser there for Adam. 1-1. Andy, that leaves you with Chelsea, Liverpool, Newcastle or Spurs?
Chelsea,
okay. Kevin De Bruyne and which other former Chelsea player have scored in the Premier League for City in a win under Pep Guardiola at Stamford Bridge?
I know Adam knows this as well. I see it on your face, mate. Don't know, mate. Can't remember.
Can't remember. Adam, you got it?
No. Kovacic.
It was Kovacic, yeah.
Start
of last season. There we go. Okay, so still 1-1. Adam, you can take the lead. You are left with Liverpool, Newcastle or Spurs?
Let's go into Liverpool.
Liverpool, who scored twice in the second half of Pep Guardiola's only Premier League win at Anfield after missing a penalty in the first half of that game?
Ilkay Gundogan.
It was Ilkay Gundogan behind closed doors. So, Andy, you need this one. Newcastle or Spurs?
I'll go Spurs, I think.
Spurs. Which player scored the only penalty he's ever taken for City in a Premier League win under Guardiola against Tottenham? If it helps, it's one of the worst penalties I've ever seen. But it went
Rodri.
It was Rodri. Yeah.
That did help, by the way.
Shocking penalty.
Absolute shocker, but nobody else was scoring him, so he took it and it went in. So there we are.
Scuffed.
Okay, 2-2. But Adam, you got the chance to win it now with Newcastle. Sergio Aguero, Omar Mamouche, and which other player have scored Premier League hat-tricks against Newcastle during Pep Guardiola's time at City?
Oh, come on, Adam, think.
I've got that face that I know this one as well.
I think. Is it Ferran Torres?
Is it Ferran Torres? It is Ferran Torres, yeah.
It was the one where he backheeled it, didn't he, on the volley.
Backheel volley,
yeah. Scott Carson in that. That was the game.
Yeah. That's it, yeah.
What a game.
Took me a minute.
There we go. Love this stuff. So Adam wins 3-2. Congratulations.
Well done, mate.
Thank you.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Listen to it. Drink it in.
Yeah, I remember that weird period where like everyone was taking a penalty because we just kept missing him. And then Rodri went, fuck it.
Rodri just goes, look, lads, if nobody else is going to score one, I'll have the next one. And then he got it. And then everyone went, okay, yeah, let's not do that again.
I think half the crowd did that as well, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Right then, bigger picture time. Because, Adam, the win at Brentford leaves City 3 points off the top of the table. I'm interested now how you rate City compared to the other teams, because at the start of the season, the way Liverpool had strengthened, the amount of money they'd spent and kind of the signings that they'd made, as I said, like they have built from a position of strength. It's something that we actually criticise City for not doing in previous years. Arsenal, where they've looked strong and physical for a couple of years, but you're not really sure whether they've got it to get over the line. And at the start of the season, as I said, City looked like the most painfully third place team you've ever seen. But now I'm not so sure.
It's between us and Arsenal. I'm confident in saying I think Liverpool will finish closer to Chelsea than us. And I'm not being reactionary on this. I did make a video before a ball was kicked this season for DAZN saying the fact that Liverpool haven't signed a centre-half or a midfielder is going to mess their whole season up and the balancing issues are just going to be catastrophic. And I was right. Got a lot of hate for it, but I was right because ultimately that was, do you know, Slot's Premier League win last year was akin to Pellegrini's, I think.
I knew you were going to say that.
Because Pellegrini won with Mancini's blueprint and all of Mancini's players peaked at the right time and he didn't really have to change the system much. We still played two up front a lot of the time. So there was parallels and what Slot had was Klopp's blueprint and what he's done by signing, first of all, Florian Wirtz. I think he's a very talented player, but from playing a three in midfield, three energetic, dogged midfielders, you put Wirtz in there, he's a natural 10, you're messing that balance up. You're then signing two strikers who are both world-class, but they're the exact same profile of striker. So what you want to bring in is two different ones. So you can either have a little and large or something different. They've got two of the same player. They've got a right-back who isn't a right-back. He's a right midfielder or even a right-winger. And then they've got a left-back who likes to bomb forward but doesn't know when to check himself now because the right-back isn't a right-back. Then they've got a centre-back who wants to go to Real Madrid, and then they've not signed Mark Gay, who would have been better than the centre-back who wants to go to Real Madrid. It is a mess. And Van Dijk's 34.
All of that said, though, like City have an attacking midfielder for a right-back, an attacking midfielder for a left-back. City are juggling things in kind of similar ways.
They do, but we weren't dismantling a league-winning team with six players coming in. We're transitioning from a position of weakness. And I think what people are forgetting, there's parallels from this season to 2021, the COVID season. Because if you remember at the start of that season, Liverpool had won the league 99 points and everyone was going, they're going to win it again at a canter. They'd signed Thiago, who at the time was the best centre mid in the world, many people thought. They signed Jota as well, who was obviously Premier League proven striker, added more firepower to their personnel up front. People thought, this is a wrap. And City were fifth at Christmas. And then lo and behold, Pep went on a, 23 unbeaten streak or something. And then we were like 10 points clear. Pep, when he figures it out with the players he's got, gets the last laugh. The only worry now is I think Arsenal are as good, if not better, right now. So it's Arsenal I'd be worried about or threatened by because they don't concede goals from open play. They just don't. It's like they're just so good defensively at the moment. And I think now with Eze in, I don't rate Gyökeres, but I think with Eze in there, it's do or die now for Arteta. Like they have the personnel, it's whether they've got the mentality. If they do, I think they'll probably win it. But if not, I fully expect City and Erling Haaland to be there to capitalise. But honestly, give it two or three more weeks, I think we'll be ahead of Liverpool in the table.
Andy, you look at the consistency and the quality of all three of those teams, and that it's really weird because you would say at various different points of this season so far, each one of them has fallen down a little bit on consistency or quality in various areas. And I'm kind of wondering where you see City in all of this, because like You could quite easily make the argument that since the last international break, City have been inconsistent. They've conceded a few late goals. They've not put teams they've had spells in games where they've been under the cosh. But at the same time, you can make the argument they've coped well when they've needed to. They're unbeaten in that time. They would have seven wins if it weren't for two last minute equalisers. So I'm really not sure where City are at the moment.
Well, I think one thing that a few people were missing out at the beginning of the season was, especially up to the first international break, the three games we played, where obviously we looked great at Wolves and then pretty poor for the other two. With the fact that Pep, before those games, said, this is our pre-season. Before the international break, this is our pre-season, because they hadn't really had one. They had Girona. Palermo as the only game before the season started. So, and we all sort of like, after Wolves, we sort of ignored that. We forgot what he'd said. And then we went into the next two games with full of confidence, understandably. But that was our pre-season. It actually was like a pre-season where you look, you know, very similar to the Club World Cup, really, where, you know, against Juve, you can say Wolves. And then the other two games were pretty poor, like we were in the Club World Cup, really. We didn't sort of finish teams off or anything. And then we come back from this national break and we have just cracked on. And I'm not saying we're perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not saying we're the finished article. But the points you make and Adam have made about defensively, how we look stronger, we look like we've got a system, we look comfortable under pressure without the ball now, which I have always thought last year we looked terrible under pressure without the ball. So I think our structures are there. I think the way we're playing is different. And that's going to take some people time to adapt as to expectations of what we are. You know, we will still trying to keep hold of the ball. We will try and pass the ball around as much as possible and push teams back. But if you notice, what we used to do in the past was if we had a break, you see Sterling or Sane or whoever running with the ball, and then they'd stop and they'd wait for everyone to catch up. And then we'd start playing the ball around again and we'd let them get back in and we'd try and just keep hold of the ball. Now we're not doing that as much. Now when we do break, we go. So you've got Doku and you've got Haaland. So we're more comfortable taking, you know, defensively controlling our own areas and then breaking because we've got the players to do it. And I think that whole profile of player is something that's not, it's not an accident. It's been created by the club, by Pep and by Linders and everything else. These, the profile of the players that we've got now are for us to break and to get in behind and everything else. But therefore, you have to have the players who accept the pressure. And I think as fans now, what we're watching is that. We're watching a team that can't control the ball. I mean, Reinders isn't somebody, he's not a Gundogan and he's not a Bernardo. He's more of a player who wants to go and carry the ball. Nunes carries the ball from right back. O'Reilly carries the ball from left back. We've got ball carriers who want to break lines with the ball at their feet, not just with a pass. So it's a totally different, for me, a totally different tactical setup. And I'm just still getting my head around it, if I'm being honest, and I'm sure everyone else is. But I think it's quite impressive to see the change as quickly and how well it's working, because we're not losing games. Mm. We're not winning them all, but we're not losing games.
Yeah, and then you kind of build that consistency from there, and you know, City win the title in May, and everybody goes, "Well, how can we possibly compete with this?" So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Hopefully, that'd be great, wouldn't it?
It'd be great if that could happen, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
We will see how that goes over the course of this season. But for now, because it's international break, we got the chance to do a few more kind of wider ranging things on the podcast this week. And after promotion in 1999, it was all change for City. Back in the second tier, after a season at their lowest ever point, they had a new look with a brand new kit manufacturer, changing from Kappa to Le Coq Sportif, and a brand new shirt sponsor after a £2 million deal with the video games publisher Eidos. Over the next couple of seasons, two different models playing Lara Croft appeared at Main Road, as Tomb Raider was one of Eidos' big titles. I've been speaking to the second Lara, whose real name is Lucy Clarkson, to get her memories of what it was like at that time.
So this is like really crazy. So I became real life Lara Croft in the end of 1999, 2000. And I was already a big model, and I was in South Africa at the time, and they said, oh, they've seen you on a billboard, they want you to represent Lara Croft. I mean, I'm this Yorkshire girl from Rotherham, like literally didn't know what Starbucks was, and all of a sudden I'm catapulted into the role of Lara Croft, and it was just literally stardom overnight. And I got, you know, booked on different types of jobs throughout the world. But the most favourable one for me was Eidos, who is the founder of Lara Croft and so on. They sponsored Man City. So I ended up being a mascot for them. So I ran on the pitch quite a few times. But there were one very like memorable moment where I always had security with me. And obviously the crowd there, it was when Man City and Manchester United were playing. And my dad at the time, bless him, he looked quite stocky and he had like a black suit on. So he was my security for the actual game. And Liam and Noel Gallagher was there because, you know, they're big fans. And they were in the player's suite. And so I ran on to the pitch. And then afterwards, we were drinking with, I was too young, but I was drinking. And my dad was singing Beatles with Oasis. And it was just such a phenomenal memory. And I still have on one of the back of the booklets, it says, "Lucy, shoot me, love Liam." So it was like a really cool thing. But that's how I ended up being involved with Man City. And it was, you know, it was amazing.
Yeah. What did you have to do around that time? Because like in my mind's eye, I remember kind of this big fanfare about Lara Croft being on the pitch. And I'm just wondering, were you feeling daft like with striking the poses and that sort of stuff?
When you say feeling daft, actually I did. You have to, but you know what? What took away the daftness and the stupid feeling about it was some people really genuinely thought I was real. Like when I used to go and act as Lara Croft, the guys would come up to me and say, "Oh my God, do you get cold when you're in the tombs?" And I would look at them and think, I mean, someone bought my wisdom teeth on eBay. Someone cycled all the way from Amsterdam on a cycle bike just to have dinner with me. So you can imagine being in an arena with Man City. People genuinely think you're real. And I looked the part. I could never speak as her because they wanted to keep it like under wraps, like a secret thing. But coming out and like running out onto the pitch and striking the poses, yeah, I felt like a daft, yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Did you meet the players and stuff like that? What were the players like?
I met the players. For the first time in my life, it was the first time I'd ever been to an actual proper soccer match. I couldn't get over it. It was like, you know, you see them on the TV and then you actually see them in real life and you see the skills. Like I said, I'm 43. This was so long ago. I can't really remember too much, but I did meet the players. I was in the players' lounge. That was quite weird, being stood like Lara Croft with like the holsters on and the guns and like talking to like the replica guns and talking to the players was a bit strange.
Did you have to give the Man of the Match award? Did you give the Man of the Match award in the Manchester Derby?
I did give the Man of the Match award. Yes, I did. And I remember just running onto the pitch and like the crowd was going wild. Because at the time, Lara Croft was huge. Like, it was such a big thing. I think I got booed by the Man United players. I'm sure I did. So I had to walk through the whole crowd and with my security and my dad and all of that. It was, like, really, really, really cool. And it was freezing.
Yeah, I was going to say it was... the Manchester Derby that year would have been around November time. So you're having to wear barely anything in the middle of the...
Yeah, I had my latex. Yeah, that had to be sprayed with, like, baby oil and, like, freezing to death while I'm trying to, like, be hardcore and be, like, this iconic Lara Croft. So I can always remember it being absolutely freezing.
What was it like kind of like in the build up to it and kind of getting there? Because I mean, I'm assuming you didn't arrive in costume, did you?
I actually did. I did arrive in costume. Yeah. And it was funny because every time we did an appearance of Lara, the guns had to be properly proven that there were replicas because obviously it could cause quite a stir. So they would make sure that the replica guns had already been sent through. They could tell that they weren't real. And the build-up was crazy. So I got dropped off actually at the arena and had to walk through the crowd as Lara Croft. And everyone was like trying to push to touch me because, you know, I'm 6 foot tall. When I was in the actual costume, I looked quite striking. It looked like Lara Croft, hair, makeup, everything. It was like phenomenal. And the build-up, I mean, I've never... That was probably the biggest crowd I've ever been. And I was 17. You know, that's quite scary. It's like nerve-wracking. And to be by yourself, to run on the pitch, and then start doing like moves and all this stuff. It's like, oh my God. But it was very nerve-wracking, I must say. I was very nervous. It was such a big job in my life and such, I mean, I'll go down in history. I mean, I'm, you know, everyone remembers me of Lara Croft. I still have fans today that reach out to me. I think I still resemble her, even though I'm like decades older. And I do. It was such a, I loved being Lara Croft. I loved it. It brought me just so much happiness seeing people like travel from all around the world just to have a signed autograph from me or touch me or ask questions, and the kids. I do miss it. I wish they would bring it back. Actually, I would. It's a shame because I would have been a really good Lara Croft, an older one, a more mature Lara Croft.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus plans November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
Lucy Clarkson speaking to me about being Lara Croft at Main Road. We're going to finish with some listener questions. Get in touch on Blue Sky at Blue Moon Podcast on there. You can email contact at bluemoonpodcast.com, and you can find us on Instagram as well. Just search Blue Moon Podcast. I've started putting a story up there where you can every week where you can just drop a few questions in. That's exactly what Jack has done. He said, can you rank the shirt sponsors we've had from best to worst looking on the shirt? I'm not going to get you to do that because there's a lot of, that's probably a top 10 we can do at some point. I'd just basically like to know your favorite one, because obviously we've just been talking about Eidos and Tomb Raider. I think this is a generational thing, and we've got two fans of different generations, so I'm interested to see where this goes. Adam, I'll start with you. Like, in terms of a shirt sponsor that looks nice on the front of the shirt, Etihad, Thomas Cook, First Advice, Eidos brother Philip Saab are the shirt sponsors that City have had. Which ones look nice for you?
So, I mean, seven's not many when you think about it, is it really? I think
No.
The Nike.
It's hard to get top 10 out of seven in London.
Give it another 15, 20 years or so, I reckon.
Straight off the bat, I think the worst ones are First Advice and Thomas Cook. I just thought they looked tackier than the rest. And then obviously, I was born in 99, so I've kind of like grown up with Etihad, really. So Etihad's like always what I would think of, but brother for me, I probably own about three brother shirts. So, you know, like the retro kits. So I'd have to say brother. I think it looks slick. I thought the font was really good. And some of the best City kits ever were when we had brother. But then looking at Phillips and Saab, there's like some, that's probably what my dad would say. Like, you know, so I don't know.
No, Andy, they might not like, do, mate.
Do not think.
he might agree with you, actually, because I'd agree with you. I'd say brother's the best one we've had.
Yeah.
For the font and everything else. And being probably even older than your dad. But basically, brother to me was, I agree with you, brother to me was the best shirt sponsorship. But the way it looked on the shirt, also the shirts around that time and everything else. I think that was in my head all the time.
Yeah, so. And then
I have to say brother because the font on the Blue Moon Podcast logo is the same font as brother, so it has to be that one.
I
will also say the first season of Etihad kits in 2009-10 were unbelievable, where we just had like the plain blue shirt and it was the third kit with the red and black diagonal stripe through it. and the gold and black away kit. 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
Absolute chef's kiss. I did like Eidos, but I can't remember if that's just because I was a child when that was the kit. So I just liked everything about City anyway, and then Eidos on the front of it just kind of looked nice. I was playing Football Manager or Championship Manager as it was then. It just kind of links in. But Adam, I'd agree with you. Thomas Cook, first advice, really didn't look good on the kits. And I'm interested, actually, Andy, you know that game that people play where it's like, who's the shirt sponsor you think of for this team? You might say Newcastle, but think of Newcastle Brown Ale or Liverpool and it's Carlsberg, that sort of thing. What do you think of for City now? Has Etihad been the sponsor for long enough that Etihad is the sponsor now?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, it'd be easy for me to hark back to the old days and all this and the other, but I think you have to accept now they've been a sponsor for far longer than anyone else. It's into the makeup of the whole club, isn't it, really, with the name of the stadium and everything else. Yeah, I think it is. You know, Etihad is probably the biggest sort of sponsor influence on the whole club ever, really.
Yeah. So here we are, the three of us, both very definitely sports washed. Reggie's been in touch on Instagram to say, is there a worry that Phil Foden's recent good form could be affected if he loses momentum by missing out on an England call-up? Adam, what do you think? You were talking about momentum before with Foden.
Yeah, he ain't going to lose momentum from not playing in a friendly against Wales and a qualifier against Latvia. I think, like, end of the day, look, clubs do this, and I think Pep's starting to do it a little bit more. Earlier on in the season, I think it's been well documented that Ferguson used to do this. He used to pull key players out of these early season international breaks just to keep them match fit, really, and not overplay them. I think Pep did that with John Stones in the last international break. I don't think Stones was particularly injured. I just think Pep was like, you're not playing in these games. And I'm not saying that's the case for Foden, but I just think it's Wales and Latvia. Like, no, you're not going to lose momentum from that, from just unwinding a little bit. We know that Phil last season maybe had issues off the pitch as well, and we don't know whether he's still managing them or figuring out new ways to manage them by giving himself breaks during the season. So, no, I don't think so. I think it will have been a decision between Pep and Tuchel or City and the FA, and it will have been in the best interest of Phil, because I think if Phil wanted to go, he would have gone. He's not been not selected based on form. It's someone who's given the green light for him not to go, which can only be to benefit him. So, no, I'm not worried about that.
It's interesting, isn't it, Andy, that the best form he's been in for quite some time, he doesn't get picked. Like it kind of feels like it has to be a little bit more than just not getting picked, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I agree with a lot of what Adam just said there. I think, again, Tuchel and Pep are big, big mates. I mean, they've known each other a long time, from German days and the other days in Germany. So there's no doubt there's a lot of conversations that have took place, and Phil's welfare would be at the right at the top of it. It is at the club, and it will be at international level. He deserves his spot on form, without a shadow of a doubt. Last year he didn't. And I don't think anyone could argue with that. But this year, he definitely does. But I think managing, and it's even like the conversation with Bellingham as well, to be fair. It's managing these big players. Yeah, managing these big players. They're all going to be playing a lot of football this year. And Tuchel knows this. And what he wants them to do is peak for the World Cup. And therefore, again, as Adam says there, you're playing Wales and Latvia. Why would you need your best players around for that? You don't necessarily need them. What you need is you want players who maybe on not going to be playing in Europe as much, you know, not be playing as many games. You can give them some game time. And also, I'll look at them as well, by the way, for your squad. Give them a chance to prove themselves. But the actual nailed-on ones like Phil, a good, you know, in-form Phil Foden and in-form Bellingham, they're nailed on for the World Cup. So you don't need to keep looking at them, and you don't need to press them and give them too much time on the pitch. You just need to manage the time. So yeah, I've got no doubt it's purely based on the welfare of players, really.
Yeah, Tuchel don't really have a leg to stand on anymore because of the embarrassment of riches that England now have. He can't call Pep and go, I need Phil Foden, because Pep can go, well, you've got Eze and Morgan Rogers. Do you know what I mean? Like, the embarrassment of number 10s that we've got is just It's the best it's ever been. So
yeah, you got Cole Palmer as well, by the way. Yeah. He's been phenomenal. And you know, I think somebody's going to miss out somewhere, by the way. Some really good players are going to miss out, which is nice to see as an England fan, to be honest with you. Really is, but it's rare.
Yeah, well, let's finish with this one from Jem on the emails, who says, I'm sure Mooney will like this one, and in honour of Donnarumma's 1v1 save against Brentford, what's the best piece of goalkeeping you've seen from a City player? Well, you're right, Jem, I do like this one, because forward the goalkeeper's union agenda. Adam, let's start with you. Best piece of goalkeeping you've seen from a City goalkeeper? Well, actually, Jem says City player, so you mean you could pick Kyle Walker in goal or
Niall Quinn, maybe. Kyle. So, piece of goalkeeping. I was debating whether that's like, does that have to just be a save? Is that one action, or can that be a half of football, a game? Because, like, the first thing that jumped to my brain was Joe Hart at White Hart Lane in his second debut for the club when we still had Shay Given. And he was peppered with about 8 shots in about 30 minutes, some of which were flying in the top corner. And the man refused to concede. He just flat out refused to concede a goal. I don't think I've ever seen a half of football that good from a City goalkeeper in terms of shot stopping. But then, piece of goalkeeping, another great one was Joe Hart.
So just before you move on from White Hart Lane, he made one from, I think it was Benoit Assou-Ekotto.
Yeah.
The shot deflected off Wright Phillips and was looping towards the top corner. He was going the wrong way and he got up and flicked it over the bar. I've never seen a save like it.
It was just insane. He did one from Defoe from about 4 yards where he hooked it off the goal line. Tom Huddleston hit one as well that he parried away. For me, it's not a piece of goalkeeping, but a series of saves in a half, it would be that. I also think the couple of years before in the derby when Rooney shot from the halfway line, and Hart was up, and he ran all the way back to his own goal. Do you know the one I'm on about?
Yeah.
And then it was about to go in.
He basically goes afterwards, it's Wright Phillips on the line again. He looks at Wright Phillips and goes, oh, I'm knackered.
Yeah, that was up there. They're the two that jumped to mind, because like Edison rarely made camera saves, did he? I'll tell you one, actually. Throw one more in. Willy Caballero in the League Cup final penalty shootout against Liverpool, where he saved like 3 of them. That was brilliant as well.
There's one in the highlights of that where the commentator says it was a nice height for Caballero. And I watch it and go, that wasn't a nice height at all. It's like 2/3 of the way up the goal. He's done well to get across to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Andy, best piece of goalkeeping you've seen from a City player?
Okay, so again, I'm like you, Adam. I didn't know whether, when I got asked this, I didn't know whether it was just one save or one performance. So performance, I've done one of each. So performance was same player, Joe Hart, Barcelona away, though. I know we got beat, but Barcelona away, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. And it's very, if you watch it back, it's very Donnarumma-esque, by the way, as well. He comes out for everything. He makes himself big. And again, I think, I mean, the plaudits after that from across Europe, I think... even the Spanish press were going mad about how good he was.
It's Messi, wasn't it? Messi said, I've never had a goalkeeper play like that against us before.
Yeah. So I think that for me was the highlight as far as keeping concerned. But the one save, or double save, I should say, in this regard, was Arne Harrison against Spurs when we beat him in the FA Cup with 10 men. And... as Ziga had already hit one in the top corner in the first half. And then, I mean, to be fair, we were all right and we were coming back a little bit. But if that the second one would have gone in the second half, that would have been game over. It would have been killed us. So the save, and he was, I think it was his debut, you understand that. I don't think he's played many games, or has he? And then he dived straight across. And he wasn't tall. He's not a big guy, was he? He must have been about 5'10", 5'11 for a keeper. Dives across, makes a brilliant save onto the crossbar from the free kick. And then makes a second save coming back, having to get up and run across it as somebody tries to head it into the net, the corner of the net, and drives across and saves that. And I thought that was outstanding keeping. Really, really impressive. So you tell me which is the best one out of them all.
I want to throw in one other suggestion and see what you think about this, because the question says piece of goalkeeping, so it doesn't necessarily mean a save. And in the, I think it's about the 92nd minute of the Champions League final, Onana lofts a free kick into the box and it's dropping about 16 yards out. And Edison calls, comes for it, catches it and drops on it. And in the last minute of a Champions League final where you're winning by one goal, you know what? Yeah. That piece of goalkeeping, I was nervous as hell when I realised he was coming for it. And then when he's on top of it and he's got it on the floor, I'm just like, yes, like that man has just, like, he's put everybody at ease. I mean, they still did then get a corner that he ended up having to make a save from afterwards. But, like, actually coming, like you said about dominating the area before, he wasn't a goalkeeper known for particularly dominating his area in that way. And then in the biggest moment of all, he's done that. I was delighted to see him do it.
Well, he did turn up in the Champions League a lot, didn't he? I mean, that save in the last minute, I mean, that could be up there with him as one of the biggest moments, certainly because of what it created for us. Because that was a brilliant save at the right time as well. So, yeah. But yeah, I was probably too nervous to appreciate it.
Too nervous, too drunk. I don't know. Like, who knows? Yeah,
yeah.
gotta get rid of the nerves somehow, haven't you? If we have missed any great pieces of goalkeeping that you would like to tell us about that we've forgotten, then get in touch. All the usual ways: bluesky@bluemoonpodcast.com, email contact@bluemoonpodcast.com as well. You can find us on Instagram. Just search for Blue Moon Podcast on there. And that is it for this week's episode. Thank you very much to my guests, Andy McNabb.
Thanks, David.
And Adam Monk.
Pleasure, thank you for having me.
We have a clip of this week's Nostalgia episode coming up shortly. That was a return to the games that made me, as Alex Kirkley, better known as the Etihad Stadium announcer, picks out his 5 matches. The full thing is available now for Patreon members. Head on over to members.bluemoonpodcast.com for more information. I'll be back next week to preview the games with Everton and Villarreal. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
The VAR decision on the John Stones goal, do you get that before anybody else? Do you get to see what the decision is?
The screen will turn a different colour. There's no visual of the game on that particular VAR screen, so you don't have like view of Stockley Park. We just get like a little box that turns a different colour and says VAR check, which we get before it goes to the screens. We know there's potential for something to come. We don't know necessarily what it is, although we have a good educated guess. We don't get the full finished piece of the jigsaw until there's a decision made by the match officials and the team at Stockley Park. So
what I'm getting at is, did you know that Stones goal was going to be allowed before the rest of us kind of twigged? There were people kind of looking over the shoulders in the press box and trying to see the VAR on the monitors there. And there was a ripple around the stadium that, like, before it was announced, like, bit by bit, the stadium started to twig that it had been allowed.
There's a smattering of people going, yeah! Which, you know, that was the players or, like, you guys in the press box. Then the crowd follows suit when the announcement goes up and it's been made official. So there must be a moment or two before that probably does happen before it gets to the fans, because we've got to be ready to communicate that to everybody outside with graphics, you know, the city logo. That all has to be prepped.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast and join us again next time for another episode.